I think for all of us that we probably share in common is that the life that we are in, the family that we're born and raised in, is a pretty powerful experience. That family is often referred to in therapy as our family of origin, or where we originated. And it's a tremendously powerful experience, and the impact of that experience is usually not restricted just to our childhood. The way we see ourselves, the way we look at the world, even our ideas about God, so much is shaped in that original family. And really the views that we develop there tend to stay with us throughout our lifetime. And I think at some point, most of us certainly leave our families physically, but I think leaving our family emotionally is a little bit of a different kind of challenge, and not as easy. Even if you put the Cascade Mountains between maybe you and your family, which I think some people do when they come to Holden, still doesn't prevent us from continually kind of reenacting the dynamics of our original family and the new family that we come into, be it our job or our community. I think some people have told me at Holden, and I know this even for myself, that even coming to Holden and moving into the community here, we find ourselves acting out some of the same roles we played in our own family that we grew up in. We tend to do that in our jobs, we tend to do it in our churches, and really in any kind of a community that we get involved in. And I guess an example of that, you might do many of the things your parents did, even though you always swore that you were never, ever going to do those particular kinds of things. And I think one of the most difficult things in our life is really to gain the emotional separateness from that real, real powerful family environment, and then to not continually repeat it, or maybe even react against it. And that's really what I'm going to be talking about this morning, in terms of learning, or I guess talking about recovery being having a better life here and now by learning a different way of dealing with our leftovers from sort of there and then. I think if all of us are willing in some way to look at some of the unfinished business of our past in kind of an appropriate context, I think our present and our future life experiences can be more positive. I want to just do an exercise for a minute, ask you to close your eyes for a moment, and to think about how you feel when you visit or phone your parents, if you have the option of them still being alive, or it could be maybe another member of your family. Do you feel or act similarly to the way you did when you were living at home? And how long is it, or how long can you last maybe before the old feelings start? 5 minutes? An hour, 2 days? And then what happens to you when things start getting tense? I usually say that if you can last more than 3 days before acting like a teenager again when you're visiting your family, you probably don't really need to be here. That's a good way to look at it. The history of what I'm going to talk about this morning really comes from working with families dealing with chemical dependency, and I want to say that usually that was done to patients' families when they were in treatment. That's where most of this came from. But I also, I guess, want to expand that a little bit, and I know for many people when they hear this lecture end up saying, God, you know, I didn't grow up in an alcoholic family. A lot of what you're talking about certainly relates to me. And so a lot of our terminology has been expanded, and we now begin to talk about functional and dysfunctional families, and you probably even are a little overdosed on that word. But it's, for right now anyway, it's kind of the best one that we can have. Dysfunctional being any kind of a distress, I'd like to use, or a condition that exists when the family life in some way gets out of control. And a dysfunctional family in some ways has difficulty dredging up the resources, and the stress continues to really further further the strain or the fragmentation in the family. I think a distinction might be made in terms of a functional family, and again, I look at this as a continuum, healthy and maybe less healthier families being on a continuum, rather either or, black or white. A functional family being one, when faced with the stress, draws upon its resources in such a way to meet that stress, they end up coming out of it stronger. They get strengthened by sort of, you know, trying to deal with it. And a dysfunctional family, I think when the stress comes, rigidity starts to happen, and some of the things I'm going to talk about in terms of people getting locked into roles and kind of getting stuck in some ways. I usually like to bring in a mobile when I do this lecture, just because I think a mobile is a real good analogy in looking at families. A mobile is an art form, I would say, and it's usually made up of strings. At least the one that I had butterflies on it, and has strings and little separate things that hang, and has various parts. And the beauty of a mobile really lies in its ability to kind of move and change and shift with the current of air as it comes into a room. And we like to watch it move and kind of make that adjustment. And that flexibility and that balance is really what you know makes it so beautiful. And the mobile has a way of kind of responding to things as it comes, in a way that what is a mobile really always trying to do? Is to get balanced, right? It responds to things as it comes, and it has the ability to kind of shift and change. And it changes positions, but it always remains connected, right? It's not possible to kind of pull on one part of a mobile and not have the rest of the mobile have to do something in order to counter that balance. And if I flick maybe one part of the mobile, the suspended part, it kind of gives energy to the whole system to kind of make some movement and shift and adjust to it. And a family in many ways is really just like that. A family has all these separate parts, but they're also connected. You have felt that, you know, if you've been in a family, which most of us have. You're separate, but you're also connected. And sometimes trying to remain, you know, kind of keep that tension there is really very difficult. You want to feel separate, but you also want to feel connected. And the beauty, like that mobile, in families is the ability for it to kind of shift and change and make adjustment as things happen to it. And that's why you can't ever sort of look at a family in some way and pull on one part of it and say, well, that's just that one particular family member that's getting affected. It doesn't affect anybody else. And we know that that's not true, which is why we found that, you know, taking somebody who had chemical dependency or alcoholism, to stick them in a hospital and just deal with them and fix them and then put them back in the family didn't make any sense, because this family had already shifted and made adjustments. And it was like trying to put somebody back in something which was going to come, all the forces were there to sort of make it go back to the way it was before. And we all feel that force. Sometimes we may feel like, well, I've separated from my family and I'm really different now. And then we go back there and all of a sudden we feel sucked into those same old kind of dynamics we used to have with the family. And it's like a powerful force that just kind of takes over. And that's why when I, you know, try to have people look at families, it's real important to see that, like that mobile, you can't just have something happen to one person in the family and not expect that it's going to affect the rest of the family. I don't know for you, but early on in my own life, I kind of used to look at troubled families and try to figure out who the person was that was causing all the trouble, right? And once I figured that out, and if we fixed just that one person, the family would be just fine. I used to think that about my own family, and of course it was my sister who needed to be fixed. And, you know, it doesn't work that way. There's usually somebody who plays that scapegoat role that I'll talk about, but all of us contribute in some way to that dynamic on that mobile, keeping things balanced. And so if anything, I would say to you, when you look at families, to try to remember that everybody in that family is really doing the best they can with what they know at that particular moment in time. And that what everybody is doing is just trying to keep things balanced. And it will help you and me to understand why people are doing what they're doing when it doesn't make any sense to us. Their behavior seems totally, irrational or not, just unexplainable. And yet they are fitting a role that tries to help, that is helping that family in some way to keep balanced. They're all contributing in some way to keeping sort of that stability, so to speak, if you want to call it stability. So as we talk about the different ways that people do that in families, try to keep that in mind. What is this behavior sort of doing to help things keep balanced in that family? What do they represent to the family? Okay. I'm going to be talking about chemical dependency families, but I'm actually probably going to be, you can compare it to any kind of other kind of dysfunction. People will say my dad was maybe a workaholic, or my dad or my mother was a compulsive spender or a compulsive cleaner. They were maybe even in some ways just addicted to their religion in some way, in some kind of a negative way, that's all that they could live or eat and breathe. Maybe they were just very controlling families. Maybe they were frozen emotionally, not able to share feelings in any kind of way. Whatever it is, I think you can kind of make the jump. But we can talk about some common characteristics that go on for everybody in the family. And once again, people will say, well, you can always see what's going on with somebody who's chemically dependent, but what do you mean when you say that there are symptoms of that in the family? What I'm going to say is that these are five things that you're going to see in everybody, regardless of whether they're the chemically dependent person, the spouse, or a child. And the first one is one that we call the big D, or denial. And once again, you may say, well, the chemically dependent person, certainly they're always in denial. You know, I can quit any time. It's not that big of a deal. I'm not the one who's got a problem. You are. All those kinds of things. But actually, the family participates in that denial even more so in some ways, in the fact that they're doing a lot of things to cover, to protect, to not want to talk about it, to make excuses for the person who is really having, in some ways, the identified problem. And so denial is one of the biggest ones. You know, children will, oftentimes, if they get asked about their family in school, they may even make up stories about how wonderful and great things are, all participating in some kind of way. We often say it's like having a big elephant in the middle of the living room. Everybody in the family knows this elephant is there, but we all walk around it. We maybe even clean up after it. But we never ever say, heck, you know, we've got this elephant in our living room. It's like the whole conspiracy of silence that goes on. Another common trait or characteristic is compulsive behavior. And once again, you might say, well, certainly the person who's drinking or using is doing that in a compulsive fashion, but what do you mean the rest of the family has that? And usually, children or spouses then will have compulsive behavior, like either compulsive spending, maybe a drive for perfectionism. Children feel like they have to perform really well at school and can't make any mistakes. They might be into compulsive exercising, compulsive eating, maybe compulsive gambling, any kind of compulsive sexual activity. But there's a real sense of compulsive behavior, which is behavior that people tend to feel like they don't have a choice in doing. They're just driven to do this in a particular way. The third common one is frozen feelings or frozen emotions. And this is where families tend to just put their feelings kind of like in the freezer and end up not talking about them. They don't talk about being afraid. They don't talk about feeling guilt. They don't talk about feeling ashamed. There's a real no talk kind of rule that goes on. And when families come into treatment, very often they'll describe their treatment experience as one of, I'm feeling like I'm thawing out. That's what it feels like. I feel like I'm thawing out. And that's because they're starting to feel and to begin to share some of the feelings that have kind of had the lid on for a long period of time. So the frozen feelings is another common one that everybody shares. Another one is low self-worth. And this is where everybody in the family feels usually some shame for what's going on. Not very proud of what's happening in the family. Now that might be covered up with all kinds of other behaviors like, you know, excelling and high achieving. But inside, there's always kind of that undercurrent of, I'm not really very proud of our family. I feel like I need to kind of prove to the rest of the world that we're not all that bad, maybe in some way. And then just feeling some shame about that. And then finally, the last one that everyone usually shares in some way are health complications. And once again, you might say, well, the person who's alcoholic or chemically dependent, obviously they're going to have health problems, right? What they're doing to their body. But research is finding that we're seeing health problems show up in the family long before we're seeing them than anybody else. They tend to go to the doctor more. And of course, usually the physician doesn't ask them what's going on at home or, you know, is your wife or husband or child or drinking or using something. And so consequently, they get treated for all kinds of ulcers, migraines, insomnia, obesity, all kinds of things that are really just symptomatic of a more serious kind of family cancer that's present there. So the health complications usually show up, bedwetting for children, eating disorders, all kinds of things. And so these are five common maybe symptoms, if you want to say, of a family disease that often don't get cited. And then I'd mention three rules that usually go on in a dysfunctional family or a chemically dependent family. And those are don't talk, don't trust, and don't feel. You don't talk about it. You don't trust one another. Usually there is in families what we call triangular communication, which just means there's usually a lot of three-way communication. And all of us get caught up in this, in friendships, in our work relationships, where A here has an issue with this person over here, but they always talk to this person over here about it. And usually these two maybe are the people who need to talk, but usually this person becomes kind of the focus of the communication. And that's real dysfunctional because what does it serve to do? What do you think?
Oh, distrust.
Yeah. And it doesn't allow these people to deal with their relationship, right? In my own family, my sister was kind of estranged from my mother. And they just had a very conflicted relationship growing up. And I was 3 years older than that sister. And I was always running interference between my mother and her. And, you know, I would tell my sister, oh, my mom really loves you. I know she really cares about you. And then my mom would say, oh, you know, Jennifer never calls me, blah, blah, blah. And I'd say, oh, I know. I just talked to her. She's, you know, concerned about you and mentioned it's your birthday. And, you know, it was a very powerful position for me, but it was very dysfunctional to their relationship because what I needed to tell both of them was, you don't need to tell me that. You need to tell them that. And that's really how you get out of it is to begin to say, you're talking to the wrong person. You know, I'm not the one who needs to hear it. The other person is. But that goes on in dysfunctional families a lot. It happens in communities and work settings as well. But you can do a lot for improving the dynamics of whatever kind of family you might be in by kind of stepping out of that role or not participating in it. So rules in a chemically dependent family then are don't talk, don't trust, and don't feel. Now I want to talk about different ways that people survive those dysfunctions. And I'm going to be talking about a family that's a mom and a dad and four children. And none of us probably grew up in a mom and a dad and four children. But I'll use that just as kind of a case. And I guess what I'd ask you to do is maybe look at combinations of behaviors or roles that look familiar, or maybe at times where you might have maybe played that role and then moved into to something else. But I'll use those four kind of as my sample. And I want to start with the chemically dependent person, or the identified patient, so to speak, not because they're the most important, which we often think, but just to start there. What are some kind of behaviors that you see when somebody is maybe actively chemically dependent, or maybe in denial of something that's maybe wrong with them in some kind of way? What are some behaviors that you see on the outside?
They're defensive in whatever they say.
Defensive? I wrote denial, but I missed
it. Well, that too.
Yeah, I was thinking that. What else?
Irrational behavior.
Yeah, unpredictable.
Mm-hmm. Getting angry quickly.
Anger, definitely.
A lot of preoccupation.
Mm-hmm. Blaming.
Right. Anything else?
Are they often loners? Often themselves?
Might be. Certainly alone in the sense that they probably don't confide much. We'll talk a little bit about that.
Rebellious?
Maybe. Yeah.
Defiant, maybe?
Setting their environment to meet their needs so they can have what they need readily at hand.
Yeah. What would you call that?
Manipulative,
somebody said? Yeah. I used to use manipulative and write that up there, and then, I don't know, for some reason I kind of began to think that it was kind of a strong or harsh word, even though I think it's pretty accurate. But I've chosen to use another one for what it's worth. I call it charming. I think people who are chemically dependent get really good at charming people around them into believing certain things about themselves. Anything else?
I think about irresponsible.
Less responsible for things. Yeah, certainly moving towards irresponsible, but letting go of responsibilities, you bet. And they usually do that in a charming kind of way. Yeah. And there's usually people around to do it, pick up the slack.
Controlling?
Very controlling,
yeah.
Kind of related to that, I think you also see some grandiosity. I can handle everything. No big deal. I'm in charge. It's not that bad. Some real grandiose kind of thinking, a real lack of ability to see sort of the impact of some of their behavior. The denial, diluted almost in some way. Okay. I guess I might also add maybe some grandiosity, or not grandiosity, but aggression. Maybe over here by anger. And sometimes some perfectionism. Wanting things to be perfect is also a good way to kind of blame or make excuses when they don't go that way, which is another good reason to continue to use. Okay, all this is going on the outside. What do you think is happening on the inside?
Lots of fear.
A lot of fear?
Low self-image?
Mm-hmm.
Lack of courage.
Yeah, I think that goes with fear. A lot of pain. Guilt. Shame.
Loneliness.
Definitely. And hurt. Are people usually, people around the person have access to those feelings or know that that's going on?
They usually think it's the opposite.
Yeah. What we're reacting to is usually all this stuff, right? And maybe at the point of maybe a period of remorse, or maybe after a binge or something, they might let you have access to some of this on the inside. But usually there's a very thick wall that's been built up, the wall of defense, from any of having access to any of those feelings. And mostly what we react to and see is all this stuff on the outside. Okay, now I want to move to the next person. The other thing might be some rigidity. I want what I want when I want it. The next person I want to talk about is someone we call the chief or the prime enabler. Now, the chief enabler is often the spouse or the parent of somebody who's chemically dependent, but it's the person who is closest and most dependent upon by this person. It's the person who gets more and more involved in what's happening to this person. And as the growth of the illness progresses in the person who's chemically dependent, so does the involvement of this person. They get more caught up in what's happening to them, and their life becomes more and more focused on what's happening to them. And the chief enabler gets really good at enabling. And the way I like to define enabling is not allowing somebody else to experience the consequences of their own behavior. I'll say it again. Enabling is not allowing somebody else to experience the consequences of their own behavior. In other words, stepping in the way and not letting the natural course of events take place so that the person has to take responsibility for their own behavior. We all get caught up in doing that. We all have the potential to kind of enable in maybe potentially a harmful way, thinking that we're maybe helping in some way. But what are some things that you see the enabler or that kind of codependent is another word often used to describe that person. What are some behaviors that you often see that person doing?
Making excuses.
Lots of excuses, yeah. What else?
Rescuing the person.
Rescuing. Covering. Protecting. Making the phone calls when they're unable to get into work, bailing them out of jail or out of their drunk driving charge, or giving them money. But what are some other behaviors that you see in terms of their own kind of makeup?
Kind of martyrdom.
A little bit of martyrdom, or almost like powerlessness. I can't do anything. Often people will go to this person and they'll say, "Can't you do anything about this person? Can't you make them stop? Can't you straighten them out?" And, you know, we think somehow that this person has some control over this other person. And that's what this person tries desperately to do. But they often come across as the victim and feel like they don't have any power to do that. They keep, you know, I wish I could straighten them out, but I can't. And they end up, you know, feeling very much like a martyr. What else do you see?
Probably low self-esteem, too.
Yeah, along with that powerlessness. They blame themselves usually a lot. They think if I would just maybe have the meals ready on time, be a better lover, be a better spouse, be a better looking, whatever, maybe this person would stop drinking or using.
Are they real dependent on the person?
They are, and yet they're also incredibly super responsible. Mm-hmm. They're the one who's like the chief cook and bottle washer. They're doing everything. They're escorting people around. They're being both, maybe playing both roles. And back to my mobile, this person is becoming less responsible, right? Over here. So what's got to happen over here? Yeah, she's got to become, or he has to become more responsible in order to keep that balance in the family. So what the chief enabler's primary role to the family and what they represent is that they bring a sense of responsibility to the family. Why didn't I do this? Or so they're also usually full of a lot of self-pity. They too also get very good at what we call manipulation or charming. Very good at it. Statements like, you know, honey, why don't you take the kids with you when you go to the store? Which is really, I don't want you to stop at the tavern, so I'm going to, you know, try to slip the kids in, or they try to control situations at parties, thinking that they can maybe control the amount. Maybe measuring how much has been taken out of the bottle, maybe dumping out bottles, doing all kinds of things to try to, you know, make get a handle on what's happening in the family. They're also usually pretty serious. They're usually pretty serious, responsible types. And doesn't it make sense if this person is becoming less responsible? This person will often say this, why don't you lighten up a little bit? You know, come on, let's have some fun. You're always so serious all the time. And this person is, you know, naturally saying, well, somebody's got to take care of things around here. You're never, you know, here to do it. I've got to just handle everything. And they really believe that. So they're usually pretty serious. They're usually people pleasers. Because usually when you ask this person, how are things in the family, what do they usually say?
Great.
Things are fine. They have this pasted on smile on their face. You know, and the burden of the world on them. And they'll say, our family's just fine. We're doing great. Look at all these things that are happening. We're just fine. We're just fine. And they get real good at believing that, you know, as well. And so they're usually people pleasers. But the responsibility is usually what they provide to the family, because as this person loses more and more control in their life due to their chemical dependency, this person is trying to gain the control. It's the phenomenon that's described in the book Women Who Love Too Much. Where else? I don't know. In many ways, looking at the whole history of women, I think we're sometimes set up for some of those dynamics. But this is not a sex-linked, you know, role. It's equal opportunity. And I often tell the story in my naive sort of beginning career. I was working in an inpatient program in Wisconsin in a mental health center, and we had a person come into treatment who basically came there just to get his wife back. She was threatening divorce, and so he was willing to go into treatment just to get her back. A real common scenario. And so he came into treatment, and his whole goal was, you know, to try to get her back. And she, of course, had said, like she'd said many times before, I've had it. I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm through. I'm done. It's over. Well, his whole goal in treatment was to convince us, to convince her, that she should take him back. And he didn't apply this with a little bit of pressure. It was a lot of pressure. And I was only 22 at the time, and I did not grow up in an alcoholic family and really was sort of learning on the job. But, you know, nurses can be real suckers for this kind of role too. And so anyway, he came into treatment and was kind of like this model patient, and tried to do everything exactly right so that we would be sure and convince his wife. And we kept inviting her to come into family treatment, and she would say, no, I don't want anything to do with him. And he kept saying, you know, you got to get her in here, you got to get her in here. And so finally, she did consent to come in for this family session. And it was kind of a complicated family situation. I think that there had been some abuse of some kind, or perhaps even incest, I'm not exactly sure. But I was really worried about this family session, and she had consented to come in like this following day. And so I went home and I was agonizing over it and how it was going to go. And this guy, you know, had kept saying, oh, you got to just tell her what a good first step I did, and I'm going to, you know, stay sober and I'm never going to drink again, blah, 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 you know, all that. So I went home and I didn't sleep a wink that night. I mean, I was really worried about this guy and his treatment and this session, and was really tired. Came into the nurse's station the next morning and pulled out this guy's chart, and the nurse on that shift that night had charted slept like a log. And I thought, you know, what's wrong with this picture? He's the one with the problem, but I'm the one who didn't sleep last night. And I think for all of us, I mean, I kind of like to use a gauge for myself, is if I'm working harder at somebody else's problem than they are, chances are I've probably, kind of fallen into some enabling in some kind of way. We've got to allow people to experience the consequences of their own behavior in order for us to make changes. None of us make changes in our life when things are, gliding along. And a real loving thing to do, sometimes called tough love, is to love somebody enough to let them assume the responsibility for their life. I mean, people do it as parents, and it's probably a real painful thing to do. But it's so necessary for any person's really growth and ability to see their reality. Because if I continue to cover for that other person, why should they make any changes? You know, they're not experiencing any consequences that are going to thrust them into looking or reevaluating their life. So that's my own story of enabling, I guess. Those things are all going on the outside. What do you think is happening on the inside for somebody who's fallen into that role in some kind of a relationship?
Bitterness.
Yeah, although you sometimes see that on the outside. I think that's more of an outside one. Sadness. A lot of sadness, sure.
Loneliness.
Lonely.
Frustration.
Very much frustrating.
Guilt.
Just helplessness feeling.
Guilt.
Pain.
Helpless.
Exhausted.
Very much exhausted.
Pain.
These are the people who are constantly saying, I'm really tired. I'm really tired. And they should be. They're really living two lives. Mm-hmm. We sometimes say that you can spot a chief enabler because on their deathbed, somebody else's life passes before them. But on the inside, they also have a lot of anger, at, getting caught in this. And fear, a tremendous amount of fear that the world is going to find out, that they're going to figure out what's going on in this family. And they have a big responsibility to keep it covered up. So, okay. Now I want to move into the children. And the first person I want to talk about is someone we call the family hero. The family hero is often the oldest child, usually, and they're the person in the family who can really hear and see a lot more of what's going on. They feel a tremendous amount of responsibility for the family pain. If only the family would listen to them, they have the answers. The hero tries really hard to make things better for the family, and they work diligently to try to improve the situation. They're usually the oldest child, and because of their inability to save the family from disaster, they typically feel very inadequate. But that inadequacy is usually covered up with a lot of high achieving and excelling behavior. The feelings of inadequacy often become so intense that they feel a tremendous amount of guilt. But their role is also characterized by a lot of anger. And that's kind of understandable given that a lot of expectations are often placed on this person. They often are usually very much, in some ways, become the confidant to this person and almost replace, in some ways, the relationship, the marital relationship. They attempt to be helpful to the family in order to help themselves. They're often seen as a success in the world, the person who has it made. They look all together. And they're usually resistant to kind of family treatment because they don't think they have any problems. They certainly know what all the rest of the families are, but they don't have any problems. And they've learned that the best way to stay out of trouble with the chemically dependent person or this troubled person over here is to be perfect. And they work very hard to do that. They look for ways to give people what they want. They too usually become really good people pleasers. they're usually the person that will almost say, you know, hi, I'm Jackie, how do you like me so far? Because they're really good at trying to please other people. They consequently, they'll never learn how to satisfy their own needs. Usually they work hard for approval. They usually get high grades. They're the honor students, the captains of the football team, the president of the student council, the homecoming queen, just your basic high achiever. They're also very responsible, usually. And they look all together on the outside. They usually become overextended in a lot of things that they do. And they usually tend to deny any negative feelings. It's not okay to say, I'm angry or I'm scared. They usually tend to always be smiling and happy and feel their contribution to the mobile is what? What do you think they contribute to the family or represent? They bring self-worth to the family. The rest of the family can point to this person and say, our family's not so screwed up, look at how good they're doing. They're usually the type that go on to become teachers, nurses, doctors, lawyers, you know, high-achieving kind of people. And although that's true for firstborns anyway, it's more exaggerated even in dysfunctional families. They are very high risk for usually marrying into chemical dependency. This person is a real setup to become the chief enabler in relationships later on in adult life. They're likely to leave the family early for other commitments as soon as possible. They leave physically but not emotionally. They continue to be the one that stays on top of everybody's birthdays, make sure families are happy when they get together, feel a lot of responsibility for kind of the well-being of the family. And they like to do what's right. They're usually very good at doing things the right way. They're often perfectionistic. They can perform well. They do better at performance than they do at being, because they've learned that you're rewarded in this family more for what you do, not who you are as a person. They're usually very perceptive and visibly successful. But the inside is a whole other story, because the big feeling on the inside for the family hero is inadequate. They too feel guilt. Maybe if I just perform more, the family will get better. Maybe if I'm just a better student. They usually learn to prefer admiration and respect to intimacy and love. They feel better if people are saying, you're great, you're wonderful, you're really good, and can handle that for their performance as opposed to intimacy and love. They're usually pretty hypercritical and judgmental, and they want other people to live up to their high standards. Nothing and no one is ever really quite good enough for the family hero. They're often the special child. The rest of the family says, oh, Mom and Dad always did like you best. You're the one that they really picked out and confided in. Now, none of those are necessarily bad things. The consequence, though, comes without treatment. Family heroes usually tend to become workaholics, overextended. They have trouble admitting that they're ever wrong. They feel responsible for everything and everybody. People like to hire them in organizations because they perform very well. They tend to marry dependents. The thing with treatment, though, and with help, they can learn to express their feelings and learn to set limits. They can learn to become responsible for themselves and not for everybody else. They make good executives. They need to learn how to take risks and to be vulnerable and to really be able to accept failure. Often, there was a research project done a few years ago where they looked at 10 medical schools across the country, and a very high percentage of medical students were family heroes coming from alcoholic or chemically dependent families. And then we wonder why physicians maybe don't understand this disease or have their own issues involved. They tend to go into the helping professions, and they're more comfortable leading than following. And they usually have trouble developing potential in other areas outside of their performance. They're usually really pretty performance-oriented. And once again, their role to the family on the mobile is to provide some self-worth. Feel free to stop me if you want to just kind of ask a question. I'll summarize some things at the end. The next role I want to talk about is someone who's called a scapegoat. And the scapegoat is usually the person who's really in the family's public eye. Everybody knows the scapegoat and the trouble that they're getting into. Because the scapegoat's already learned in this family that you're, again, that you're not rewarded for who you are, but for how you perform. And no way are they going to perform like the Goody Two-Shoes family hero. And no way are they going to kind of work that hard to prove themselves as worthy. So they tend to really pull themselves away from the family and to create a family somewhere else. And that's usually like with their peers. Their friends kind of almost become more of their family. And they're usually not any of the kind of friends that the family hero would choose. I know in my own family, I'm sort of a recovering family hero, I like to think, in some ways. But, you know, I could never understand why my sister would hang out with these sort of muck-a-muck friends. I mean, why did she want to hang out with, you know, the good people at school? And there was usually, there's usually an element of competition between the scapegoat and the family hero. Scapegoat not wanting in any way to compete with the family hero. But often the scapegoat is usually angry at the parents and at themselves, and they use that anger to kind of mask out other feelings, but you often see a lot of anger. They're usually pretty defiant and rebellious, getting into trouble, often get labeled the troublemakers. They may get into their own chemical use, may get pregnant at an early age, might get kicked out of school, kicked out of home. They divert attention from who? The person over here. They, because what happens is then everybody starts to point their finger at the scapegoat and say, you know, this family would be just fine if that scapegoat would straighten out. And who kind of gets taken out of the picture but the chemically dependent person? They're kind of going, at least I'm looking at them for now. Mm-hmm. And I've got a perfect excuse for my drinking and my using and all my problems, right? Because I've got this acting out kid. And usually it's the scapegoat that kind of drags the family into treatment. Our family has a problem here because of this person. They're getting into trouble. They often kind of look like they have an uncaring attitude and maybe kind of sullen. They fight for recognition in whatever way possible, but usually push lots of people away from them in the course of doing that. They usually have a low self-worth and get little positive feedback for what they do. They're a high suicide risk, scapegoats are. They're also the one at highest risk for developing chemical dependency themselves. We know that 1/3 of all children in a chemically dependent family will become chemically dependent, and another 1/3 will marry into it. So it's very high. The scapegoat might exploit their friends to get what they want. And they're likely, like I said, to become chemically dependent also. But their role and contribution is to take the focus off of the alcoholic. On the inside, what's going on for them is, if you can imagine what it must feel like if everybody else is kind of going like this and saying, you're the problem, what do you think would be a big feeling for them?
Poor self-worth.
Yeah? And a lot of rejection. Hurt and guilt, believing that they are the one that's the problem. And fear. If I stop being angry, somebody's going to have to also know my other feelings. Because usually fear is about the only emotion that gets expressed. without treatment, usually what happens to scapegoats, like I said, is they tend to become chemically dependent themselves, maybe end up in prison, often labeled the troublemaker later in their jobs. With treatment, though, scapegoats are the most sensitive. They make really effective counselors. They really are the most sensitive in some ways. They need to be confronted and yet listened to. They also, with treatment, can learn to accept responsibility and to have more courage and have an ability to see reality. Scapegoats are usually able to call the family the way it really is. They can kind of cut through everything else and say, this is really what's going on, and will do that. Sometimes they pay a price for it. And usually it's their behavior that comes to the attention sometimes of pastors or other friends or youth workers or school, whatever. So, but once again, their contribution to the mobile is that they kind of take the focus off of the can't be independent person. Two more people to talk about. And then we can wind it up. The third person I want to talk about is someone we call the lost child. And if I could, you know, kind of paint a picture of that person, I would have them sitting off in the corner all by themselves. The lost child is the one in the family who's kind of learned not to get too close to anybody. It's not safe. They spend a lot of time being alone, quietly busy, maybe in their room. They're the ones with the headset on, kind of spacing out. It's a safe role to be in. It's likely not to cause any trouble for the family if they can just kind of slide and be off here kind of under low profile. Most people don't even notice lost children. We tend to kind of think everything's going along fine with them. We don't have to worry about them because that's what they represent to the family, one less person to worry about. Everybody says, well, they're doing okay, so we don't have to worry about them, when in actuality there's a lot of inside pain going on, but it's well hidden. And often they don't get much attention, either positive or negative, of any kind. They're just there. And they suffer a lot of pain and a lot of loneliness in that process. Their role is to offer relief to the family. We kind of go, whew, at least we don't have to worry about that person. And the role is usually filled by maybe the third child. They withdraw. They're usually loners. And it's kind of like no news is good news when you think of the lost child, because they help to maintain that illusion of normalcy in the family. They're likely to become ineffectual. They have a very low self-esteem due to the lack of positive feedback that they get and the unwillingness to take risk. They don't make any trouble, so they often, you know, don't make any waves. One of the consequences without treatment is that they often have sexual identification problems, just to the lack of healthy identification with either parent, and kind of that self-imposed social isolation. They're the ones off reading a lot of books. They're your star readers, and maybe artists, writing poetry, writing stories, writing letters, doing those things that you can do alone. They, on the outside, you know, what you usually see is they're usually pretty quiet, withdrawn, loners. They often suffer from maybe being overweight or other kinds of eating disorders. They too are at high risk for suicide. They're often followers, not leaders. They're just really good at being invisible. They're usually pretty aloof. They become really super independent, and almost kind of exude sort of a rejection sort of feeling around them. They're usually passive, and they usually expect very little from themselves or from other people. They have difficulty developing intimate relationships with others and in making choices. Often they just go along to get along. The potential for recovery, though, in lost children is very high. Without treatment, though, they usually end up with little zest for life. Like I said, often have sexual identity problems. They might become promiscuous or totally stay alone. They often die at an earlier age. With treatment, though, they're extremely creative, lost children, because they've learned how to use their creative side being alone. They're often our artists, are talented and imaginative people. They're usually very self-actualized and have a real ability to be independent. And usually need some help kind of like with being more assertive with their world and in their relationships. But again, their contribution to the mobile to keep things balanced is that they offer some relief. We kind of say, oh, we don't have to worry about them because they're not getting into any kind of trouble. The feelings, though, that on the inside, though, are very much ones of loneliness, unimportant. Fear, guilt, and I think as you probably come to see that what's going on the inside is very similar for everybody. Again, though, the wall of denial is usually so thick that people are out of touch with what those inner feelings are. I don't know about you, but what's the tone of this family about now? What do you feel? Oh, heavy? Sad, gloomy, kind of, maybe. So in thinking of the mobile, what do we need? We need some life. We need some spirit. And usually the other role that gets brought into the picture is someone we call the family mascot. Often the youngest child, but it doesn't necessarily have to be. The mascot is the one who brings a little fun into the family. Nobody takes the mascot too seriously. We don't think they really understand too much about how life really is. We tolerate them because we need to have their humor and their fun in their life. We don't think they have very much understanding about anything. Mascots are often cute, playful, fun to be with. They'll clown around, anything to kind of get their attention. They're often very hyperactive. You'd like to pop them a Valium because they won't sit still, and they just their eyes on the move, always, you know, irritating, teasing, you know, pinching, not sitting still. They often do get misdiagnosed with learning disabilities when that may not necessarily be the case. They have very short attention span. Sometimes they're clumsy. They appear real fragile on the outside and somewhat immature. They are a perfect setup to marry family hero types, you know, who are responsible and serious and like to manage things. And somebody needs a kind of mascot in their life. And often kind of come across like they need a lot of protection. Like I said, they're hyperactive. And real playful. The big feeling on the inside, though, for the mascot is fear. If I stop clowning, if I stop joking, somebody's going to know that I really have some other feelings going on and that I'm afraid about what's happening to our family. Their contribution is to bring the fun and the life, but at the same time, they pay a tremendous price for doing that. Fear really dominates that humor and that mask. It kind of grows out of the incongruities that are in the family and sort of nurtures that need that the mascot has to kind of control other people and other situations. And they do that with their humor. You know those people in your organizations and in the groups and things that you work with. You appreciate their humor, but when it comes to a serious moment, you'd like to tell them to stop screwing off and get on with things. I do just because I'm not one, I guess. But their self-esteem is usually based on their ability to kind of to divert people and to get them away from, you know, the issue. They'll usually develop family rituals that provide structure for the good times. They're the ones you can depend on for the life of the party. They're likely to be very intelligent, resourceful, but have such a limited ability sometimes to concentrate for very long. Nobody takes them too serious. The price they pay without treatment, though, is usually they're high risk for ulcers and don't handle stress real well. They kind of become a compulsive clown. They have to use their humor almost compulsively. Tend to marry the hero types and then maybe remain immature. They also are a high probability of developing prescription addiction. That hyperactive, sense not ever be able to kind of relax makes them a high risk for getting stuff prescribed for them. With treatment, though, they can learn to take care of themselves, to use their humor in a real positive way, that they no longer have to be the clown in every situation. They often have a lot of needs to be touched. They have a lot of physical affection kind of needs.